And just do it. Just do it. Just make the appointment.
Apologies to Nike and everybody.
I'm not apologizing. Just for the record, that's Teresa, not me. Oh, I like Do It Now better.
I had to print that. I call it refrigerator therapy. So I keep anything that I'm working on, I put it on my refrigerator. And Do It Now, I had in colorful rainbow on my refrigerator for a while.
I have refrigerator therapy. It's eating. Eating my feelings.
I've got refrigerator therapy too. But
see, that's why I know we're going to go to the fridge anyway. So have the things intentional on the fridge so you read them.
Ah, got it.
At the same time. It's one of my approaches. Oh, leave it in.
Do it now, not eat it now.
Right.
That's the reframe. That's the difference. Ah. Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of Hilarious. That is Amy Redbird.
And that is Teresa Benson.
And we are so glad you're here, holding hands in the dark of all of the weird stuff going on and finding a way to laugh at it. And a lot of you who have listened to our first episode recognize a third voice. And Amy, why don't you take it from here and introduce our amazing guest today?
I would love to. This is Deborah Wallace, and she is an amazing healer on many levels. And I can attest to that because I have worked with her for, is it 4 years now? As my therapist, a deeply, deeply gifted human who has helped me out of Satan's toilet. As we know, that's one of my favorite sayings for the
spots.
Trenches.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll have to like make postcards or something like that and have them available in the store. So people can send their own greetings from Satan's toilet.
Cause we all swim in the toilet at some point. Right. So Deborah helped me out. I mean, a real lifeline out of that. And I can't thank you enough. And thank you so much for coming on the show. Welcome.
Oh. Yeah. I'm feeling love. I'm welling up with tears here. So let me breathe out. You're so welcome. You're beautiful.
And no pressure. No pressure given that lead up.
Right? I want to say, I mean, Teresa got to see me when I was in some of my worst states. So, and obviously you did too, Deborah. And I mean, I can talk about it, but for people that really witnessed it, and I actually came across a video, I may make this available on our website at some point when I'm ready. I came across a video that I took of myself, and I kind of didn't know why I was doing it when I did it at the time. It was in 2019. And that was right around the time I contacted you first, Deborah. And I had gotten your name from just an acquaintance. And she was like, she lives in New Zealand. You're going to have to do it all over Zoom. But I was so desperate. I was going to try anybody, to be honest. Anybody that came with these credentials, let me back that up. Yeah. She said she's survived a lot of her own trauma. So this wasn't just read out of a book. And so many people who had read how to do this and learned how to do it via text, you know, reading text and learning that way had made me so much worse. Doing those types of therapy made me so much worse. So all of the approaches that Deborah had were lived experience. And that was so incredibly important to me. And it turned out to be probably the best decision of my life. It was the first thing that ended up saving my life, literally. So I can never thank you enough. And the path that you took to save your own life has lit the path for many of us behind you. So thank you.
I can't ever thank you enough.
Good. So I was hoping maybe we could talk about some of the things we've worked on. Polyvagal theory, somatic experiencing. If you could talk a little bit about CPTSD and explain maybe why they're so disruptive. Because I came to you in a state where I couldn't. When I went to that treatment center in 2019, I could barely walk. I could barely stand. And I didn't really fully get what was happening. Now I understand that my nervous system was so dysregulated and so heightened. I was literally having trouble with just normal function.
Right.
So I'm going to let you take it away and
I know to... I can share. So I'm like, because originally my first, I'll start with a joke. I knew I needed to be a therapist because I would be in therapy the rest of my life. So I might as well learn the tools. So I thought maybe it'd be a deal, you know?
Amazing.
Yeah. So I did I've had to use everything a zillion times over, and it's been amazing. And really, actually, Dr. Bruce Perry, I don't know if you're familiar with him. He actually just wrote a book with Oprah, but his neurosequential therapy was like probably the first thing that blew my mind, was understanding the neuroscience behind that, what's going on in our nervous system. And it was just, wow, he just changed my life, the work of Dr. Bruce Perry.
Did you say neurosequential
therapy? Yes. Neurosequential therapy. Right. It's phenomenal.
Tell me a little bit more about that. What's that about?
What he can do is he can map out, because that's why I love my master's in human development studies. There is a trend, you know, there is a path that we go on, and you can indicate by symptoms and milestones that aren't being met, you know, not always the case because it's a broad range, but his work, he's been able to identify where the trauma occurred. So it could have occurred in the wound. Like, he can map out. It's amazing. Neurosequential therapy.
Wow.
And yeah. It's phenomenal. So like looking at seeing the expressions, the behavioral, all that jazz, and map out where it happened in the womb, where it happened in the development, because the brain develops from bottom up. So this is where a lot of the somatic work. So bottom, a lot of the therapy that trauma really needs is bottom up work.
Okay.
Talk therapy. When you go ahead.
Well, and so for the listeners, you're making a fist and sort of pointing at the wrist.
Yes.
And I'm assuming that the hand and the knuckle is the brain.
Yes. So
whereas the wrist is kind of the brainstem.
Brainstem, correct. And the thank you. I know. I use the brainstem. No. I show everybody the brain model.
Well, and I know this is what, the amygdala, right?
Amygdala, yes, tucked in the middle.
Yep. So we'll put a couple diagrams of fists and fingers and thumbs on our Instagram.
Yeah. Exactly. I show everyone this model, and I learned it from Bruce Perry, because the brain develops from bottom up, and it's like a sequential order. That's why he calls it neurosequential therapy, because there's an order. It's bottomed up, and a lot of that bottom stuff is sensory input, you know, into, you know, there's so much that's happening there, and so a lot of people who've had trauma, especially developmental trauma. And then complex PTSD is actually trauma that has occurred in relationship. That's why it's not just one trigger. It's not just one event. It's a trauma that has occurred in a relationship, a dynamic, an environment. And that's why it's so complex.
Right. Oh, and wow. To me, it was like having that explained was so eye-opening. Because for a long time, I didn't even know I had PTSD. It really wasn't until after I had my child, which brought up a lot of stuff for me. And it really wasn't until years after that, that I discovered CPTSD was a thing and what it really was and how massive a wound that is. It isn't like I had a wound inside of me. It's like I lived inside of a wound. And that is just where I lived. And to me, that's the difference between PTSD and CPTSD. So
interesting. Yeah, I hadn't really heard of CPTSD until really the last few years. And I remember, too, when I started therapy, I was diagnosed with OCD, clinical depression, and PTSD. And I was in such denial. I'm like, no, I mean, I'm from like Des Moines, Iowa. I haven't experienced PTSD, you know? I'm like, not, I've had the most vanilla life. You know, PTSD is for people who have been through war. And, you know, it's exactly, Deborah shaking her head. Yes. And the thing of it is, oh, I mean, I went through war in my childhood. I just thought that was reality and normal. And so it took me years to figure that out. But complex PTSD is still a new concept. So can you break it down just a little bit more?
I absolutely can, because actually it's the work of Dr. Bessel van der Kolk is actually the one trying to get it in the DSM.
The body heals the score, right?
Yes.
Or the body keeps the score.
Yeah,
got it.
So he's actually been working hard to get child developmental trauma in the DSM as well as complex PTSD. They won't take it in. And
well,
he is
fuck them.
I know.
Because he's
Namaste.
The man.
Namaste. And fuck
namaste. Fuck you,
no, right? I'm not even giving them a namaste. They're just the fuck you.
So explain for our audience really quick how that impacts people seeking therapy or seeking to be diagnosed or whatever if it is not in the DSM, because not everybody knows even what the DSM means. So can you?
Right. And I love this question because I'm not even a fan of the DSM personally anyways, because this is also from I learned from Dr. Bruce Perry was that really every diagnosis is an expression of a stressed out nervous system past its capacity. And if you think about everything the human body does and regulates 24/7, like, yeah, there's going to be a lot of variability. Especially when you look at development, when the trauma occurred in development, and we actually regress back when a trauma has occurred, we regress back to the age of the last time we felt safe. And so if you imagine, if you keep getting activated, you are just, and if you had a trauma at 2, you had a trauma at 4, you had a trauma at 16, like, it's just unbelievable. So to me, the DSM,
DSM is the diagnostic.
It's manual.
Statistics manual. Got it.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. So and if it's not in there, what does that mean?
Well, you can't put it in when you bill insurance companies. Right. And so most people, you have to pick one of these other ones, which, you know, unfortunately, there's stigma around those.
I struggle with that, getting insurance coverage, because I'm self-employed and I something people don't understand about insurance, and it's still very much an issue for people like me because I'm individual and I'm not part of a group. So because I'm not part of a group, I can still be denied for pre-existing stuff. And I have been denied many times for coverage. And so luckily I can go through the marketplace, but it puts me in a weird category because it's super expensive and it is pre-existing. So it's, you know, my deductible is insane. So what should have been my retirement has just been my survival fund. But luckily, I mean, I'm grateful to have had it, but yeah, that affects me very much.
Wow. Wow. Ugh.
Yeah. And I find when I'm able to educate people about PTSD and complex PTSD, they're just like, a weight is lifted. They're like, oh, it makes so much sense. Mm-hmm. When I explain it to neuroscience. Right.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm crazy. I'm losing my mind. I went to a residential treatment center for 30 days and left my child for a month to, at that point, I really was just trying to stay alive. Mm-hmm. One of the few things they helped me with in that environment was realizing there was something physically happening with my body, which was chronic inflammatory response. But I even came to learn through my work with Deborah and through just my own research that too is connected to trauma. All inflammation is some sort of trauma, whether it be something you eat, something you came across in your environment, or something that happened to you. It's not really, your body doesn't really register as it is something different. So, right. Yeah, it's all connected.
It's all connected, right? Because, and that's where the polyvagal theory comes in, where, I mean, the states of, if you're not in a state of calm, you can't even digest. I mean, mm-hmm. we're only meant to be in a state stressed. That's meant to be for acute time period. If you're in that 24/7 for years and decades, of course your body can't regulate and process. Mm-hmm. And so then anything is perceived as a threat. Anything you take in is going to be too much for your nervous system, mind, body, and spirit to process.
Interesting you just said that, because it never registered with me until this moment that that's exactly what I was starting to experience, that even food, even eating was starting to become a threat. And I was vomiting. I was dry heaving. It was horrific. I mean, I was getting so skinny at that point. You remember, Teresa, I do
remember.
Probably about 115 pounds. And a normal weight for me is probably more like 130. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't, I was okay, but I was getting into the territory where it was, I looked scary. I looked really gaunt. Even eating food, everything just felt, falling asleep, everything was a threat to my body. And the only thing that ended up starting to work was, I think we started with the window of tolerance. Mm-hmm. I think that's where you and I first started. So and
what is, right? What is a window of tolerance? Is that part of this polyvagal theory that you were talking about?
You know, it is a bit. It's like, it is because what it is when you're in your comfort zone, when your vital needs are met and you're feeling regulated, that's when you're calm, connected, and you can be your best self. And yes, and again, there's interpersonal neurobiology too. So it's like some people might lose weight, some people might gain weight. You know, that's where that variability comes from, because then genetics, you gotta take in all those factors. So it's gonna look different for everybody, right? So there's no right or wrong.
Oh yeah, no,
don't
no,
look
no.
Different.
I remember we talked on a previous episode about how, for me, you know, life is a choose your own adventure, and I chose the path with all the food, mm-hmm. right? Like everybody, yeah. everybody has their own way, yeah.
Right, of coping,
and neither one is good or bad. It just is, yeah.
Right,
and it's you really seeing how you're feeling in those moments. So when you're calm and regulated, like when in the vagal model, that's ventral vagal, that's at the top, which is the map of the nervous system. And so the window of a tolerance is, it definitely is kind of saying the same thing, but just showing a different image that, you know, we can go to an hypervigilance, which is the extreme fight flighty, or we can go to hypo, which is more of a shutdown. And so the latter, though, when you look at the central nervous system, it's more in a ladder format, whereas the window of tolerance shows it in the middle. Like, this is your window of tolerance. And we know that we are outside of that tolerance if we are getting hyper or hypo. We want to get back into that window. And a lot of people with trauma actually have a small window of tolerance. So it's like a smell can set you through the roof.
Or even, I remember I went through a phase, and I still occasionally, where just even air on my skin sometimes. Mm-hmm.
Right? Same.
It's almost irritating, and I have to. It can be summertime, and I have to wear a hoodie because I just, yeah.
And I went through that too.
And a lot of that is signaling that your window of tolerance, or obviously there's more stressors coming on you mm-hmm. at that point, which could be present stressors or could be past stressors. So it's important to help learn how to increase that tolerance, your window tolerance. Yet often that means, well, let's be curious. Where is this coming from? Is this a current thing that's happening mm-hmm. now, or is this being triggered from the past that needs processing so that we can expand that window?
I had a peephole of tolerance. It was microscopic. It was rough stuff, but that is what initially started to, one, it literally trained my nervous system to just tolerate what was happening. And then you know, yes, and like the basis of our whole podcast here. That was my first yes and moment with trauma and what I was going through. It was just acceptance. This is what's happening. I can't negate it. I can't give it back. I can't change it. It just is what it is. And I've got to play this hand. So it was just that first little bit of tolerating that this is what's happening. And then, yeah, it's literally like your tolerance grows. So I could stay in my skin.
Absolutely. And that's, and also the other thing I prioritize initially before even doing trauma work and processing is self-care. We can't keep bombarding the system. Like if I start opening the door to all that stuff, when you're already in a dysregulated state, you can't go there. And that's a lot of the work of somatic workers too, is less is more. If we if we dose too, even if it's a good thing and we want to do this work, it's still too much for the nervous system to process. And so I do a lot of initially self-care. What are we eating? What are our sleep patterns? How are we nurturing ourselves so that we can get to a level of calm before we start opening the door to start processing this things? Because you need to feel in control. You need to have agency. Because so many variables are out of your control. And with your routine, your self-care, that's a way that you can give your nervous system that consistency, that nutrients it needs, so it can get to a calmer state.
Yeah, that's so, that is true. And it was like, yeah, then that was the next step. It was like, what was I eating? It was just covering my bed with really soft blankets. I remember you suggesting that to me. Just having like a really snuggly, safe place. And it was like finding one spot on your body. Is there one place in your body that feels safety? And sometimes it would literally just be my feet.
I was thinking earlobe.
Or like my pinky finger. And then it was just learning to expand that feeling or just focus just on that spot that felt safe. So that is right. And then it, I remember it little by little, I was like, okay, make sure I'm drinking enough water. Make sure luckily I was, you know, well, actually at that time I would just eat whatever I could just to, I remember I was drinking a lot of like organic nutrition shakes. That's all I could stomach, but little by little that expanded.
Like, well, that's the other key point is compassion, self-compassion. I think if, I don't like to also then add pressure that you have to change all these things. It's so important to meet the person where they're at, you know, and at least being kind to yourself, like to be kind to yourself. That is so key. So many of our parts are screaming at us, yelling at us, saying we're wrong and broken. And it's so important that if all you can muster is that smoothie, then yay.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Get something in. And then I remember too, it was the self-holding, the Peter Levine self-holding techniques. That was really early on with you. And it kind of got that, I wouldn't say the switch flipped, but it kind of brought me down of a notch.
So I want to hear more about that. If you don't mind, I want to put a quick pin in it and go back to something about the routines. What about those folks who have a really, like, they rebel against any sort of a, you know, routine that gets put on them, even if it's for their benefit, or, you know, how do you encourage someone to have a safe and healthy routine and self-care and nurturing?
Well, number one, I meet them where they're at and I acknowledge that makes so much sense. And this is where I also weave in a lot of IFS work. You know, there's so common, IFS is internal family systems. I use a lot. But the number one is to meet them where they're at and say, you know, it makes sense. Right. You don't, and be curious about that. Because a lot of times people have been told what to do their whole life. And so creating a rhythm, a routine, actually, I don't even like the word routine. I prefer to say rhythm or ritual. To take that kind of routine, you must
like
do
the
that.
Rules. Yes,
that structure, that rigidness. And so I usually go there and say, you know, and get curious about that and say, how come, you know, that makes sense. Tell me more about how come you don't want to do that.
Interesting.
It does come back from childhood. Like, I don't want anyone to tell me, like, yeah, I get that. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I don't like it either.
Yeah. Yeah, me neither.
Yeah.
I resist it too, even though I know it's good.
Yeah.
That was a good question, Teresa.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah. Asking for a friend.
Yeah. Because I have parts. My parts fight each other. And then this is where the IFS came in.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so okay. Oh, I remember the firefighter.
Firefighters, right? Managers.
Yeah. Yes. I remember you said that your firefighter is big and burly, Amy.
Real big and burly. And yeah, this is why I have to do martial arts, not just to move. I do have to move my body a lot, because while I'm in a really good place in my life and in my nervous system, I have to continue to do the things that keep me regulated. And that's one of them. A lot of moving my body. But it's also because I have this big burly, this big burly firefighter part. And I need to be able to back that up.
Yeah. Yeah. So once we start with the self-care and we're getting those steps down, then Amy, you mentioned Peter Levine and what did you call it? Something holding?
The self-holding. Right. So self-holding, I'll let Deborah poses. Speak to that.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So I do a lot because that's part of the self-care too, because again, I can't teach all these tools right away. We need to keep things simple and understanding. And so Peter Levine, and based off of, you know, the body, there's points like the, you know, we have, he calls them neurofeedback. There's neurovascular holding is the more technical okay. term, where you're literally touching. So what I know I'm going to talk about it, but like if you, one of the poses is actually just a hug. You know, but you literally put one hand underneath your arm and then the other one goes over it and you're hugging yourself and you mm-hmm. breathe and you're holding points that are underneath your arm and you're holding yourself and you're breathing.
Oh, wow. It's very calming.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's almost, so I'm doing it and yeah, it's. Yeah, that's pretty calming.
And that's one of them. And I'll be honest, there are people, nope, I can't do that. And I get, okay, cool. I'm gonna teach you. There's so many. Your job is to listen to your body and do what works for you. I want you to listen to your body. That right. is key. I got so many ways, but you need to do what works for you. And then another one is putting your hand on your prefrontal cortex, which is your forehead.
Oh, or my five head.
Right. And then the other one is you put it behind your neck. And so the one behind your neck is providing containment for that part, the low brain, for that part that's freaking out and terrified. Mm-hmm. You're holding it. And then the top part of your hand is pulling blood.
Her face.
I may have to, so for the listeners, we're doing this on Zoom and maybe I'll embarrass myself and put this on Instagram. My reaction just now.
And you breathe.
Yes.
And you breathe. And then you there is more that you'll lower your head and do some breathing mm-hmm. there. And then you bring it back up. And yeah, and you breathe. And then you lower your hands and you'll notice you'll notice it.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And then wow. Isn't there another one where then it's like forehead and heart?
Yes. Yeah, so that, yes. Oh, yeah, that's right. This one touches more grief points. So yes, the forehead ones.
That's okay. the one that helped me release and
awesome.
Grief
with that grief release.
Point? So yeah, there's grief points here. So this is helping process grief. So you put the one on your forehead and then one on your heart. And then you imagine the flow of energy from your head to your heart and you breathe. You just keep taking deep breaths. Thoughts and feelings might come up and you just witness them and notice them. And then you say, bring your focus back to your head, to your heart and breathe. Then after that, a few minutes, you'll take the one that's on your forehead and bring it down to your abdomen, your core, your center, keeping the mm-hmm. one on your hand. And you repeat the same process, watching the flow of energy from your hand to your heart. So I'm experiential. I have them practice these in yeah. the moment.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That is amazing. And so that is called self-holding.
Yes. Yeah, self-holding poses.
And is that so? And that's all part of the same thing. Like, polyvagal regulation of your nervous system.
Yes.
And
yes.
then somatic mm-hmm. experiencing. So I am getting currently a lot of ads on Instagram for somatic yoga for women of a certain age. Mm-hmm. And you know, you go Google whatever it is and it's, you know, just a get rich quick thing because somebody has figured out somatic yoga and it does work and somatic mm-hmm. experiencing. And so people are trying to make money just like keto or just like, you know, whatever the big right. thing is at the time. Right. But let's talk about the real somatic experiencing a little bit. What does somatic even mean? Can you start there a little bit?
Body. I mean, it's a sensation. It starts at the body. Right. And that's when I was saying how we develop in our mother's wombs from bottom up, the somatic is the bottom of the brain. That is all those automatic processes that are happening without conscious awareness. It's brilliant. I mean, our body has so much intelligence naturally.
It does. It really does. And I remember being in such a desperate state and reading Waking the Tiger, which is one of Peter Levine's books. And I read that book and I was like, holy shit, this is what's going on with me. I can put down the idea that I'm just crazy, quote unquote. I mean, my nervous system was kind of crazy, but you know, he does this comparison where he's talking about contraction and expansion. Am I saying that right? Of the nervous system. And he uses a slinky and he explains, this is what's going on. And it was the first time in my experience of falling apart that somebody explained what was happening to me. And I was so relieved, speaking to what you said earlier, I was so relieved that I was like, okay, this is the problem. And then I shortly after that discovered Bessel van der Kolk. So it was those things that I was like, okay, this lives in my body. But then it became a years long process of finding a practitioner who does these things.
Mm-hmm. Right. So many say they're trauma informed, yet I find, unfortunately, they're not as trauma informed.
Yeah. You know what was what happened to me was a lot of people wanted to work with EMDR. And while I do believe it really helps for the state that I was in, it made me so much worse. And it's what you were saying earlier about the self-care. And getting you to a place where you feel safe and you're grounded enough to even process any of the stuff. Nobody had done that for me. Mm-hmm. And I was visibly in a shaken state. And I do believe that these practitioners were doing what they thought was right, but it wasn't right for me. And I was liking it to my career, which is hair, and it's, you know, at least it's going to grow back in 4 weeks if I fuck it up. If I didn't have the means or the tools or the skill set to help somebody with a solution that they needed, and I thought it was going to somehow fuck up their hair that would grow back in 4 to 6 weeks, I still wouldn't touch it. So I still struggle with feeling like that's an integrity problem within the community, but luckily I survived to find the right care and the right help. But it was just, they just kept digging and digging and processing and digging and digging until I literally couldn't function. So thank you for not being one of those.
Well, and that's the other thing. I do EMDR as well. And yet there is a whole protocol. You need resources. And so I do that with all my clients too, which I at the start, we do a safe place. We find a nurturing figure, a protective figure, and a container. We create a container. So those are my four resources that came from my EMDR experience that I make sure everyone has, period, whether we do EMDR or not. You need those in place. We're going to do that.
So let's talk about that. Almost like shopping around and trying to find the thing that works. How do our listeners figure out if therapy is working for them or not? You know, I'm thinking about some of the things that you said around feeling things in the body, Amy, even some of the things that you've said about how those therapy sessions made you feel. What are, you know, we talk about red flags in relationships and we talk about beige flags, green flags, right? But when we think about therapy, you know, for a lot of people, it's already a brave motion to go make that appointment. And then if you're like some folk where you feel guilty for putting out the therapist if they aren't the right therapist for you, just like a hairstylist. Mm-hmm. If they do your hair one time and you're like, yeah, I don't think they get me. Mm-hmm. It's almost hard to tell the hairstylist, yeah, no, mm-hmm. I don't want to see you in 6 or 12 mm-hmm. weeks, right? So how can listeners, as they think about their own mental health and seeking out care, determine if the tools are working for them?
Mm-hmm. Well, there, I think it's important first, when you're first researching, to shop around, to literally, I offer a free consult. So I think it's important for clients to say, do you offer a consult? Do you offer, can I ask a few questions? I have a few key questions. I think that's fair. And I think if that therapist isn't going to answer those questions, then maybe that's their cue that I'll go look for somebody else. You know, I offer mm-hmm. that. I think that's important. It's a huge commitment.
You know,
your safety needs to be important.
I just thought of something. I mean, we absolutely expect that, like from a mechanic, if there's something mm-hmm. wrong with your car, you fully expect that a mechanic yes. will give you an estimate on what it's going to yes. take and answer some questions for you.
Yes.
And yet so many people don't feel that they can ask right. that of a professional mm-hmm. in your capacity. Wow.
So that's my first thing. I say, ask questions, have a list, mm-hmm. ask questions and ask a few different therapists so that then you'll get their answers and you'll feel that in the body. You'll feel which one feels a little more resonant, lighter for you. And that's the one you want to choose. And then the same thing, we're still human. It might have sounded good in those questions. You start doing work with them and you're feeling, not quite feeling hurt. You know, therapy's hard. You're going to get uncomfortable, period. Yet mm-hmm. if it's going on consistently and you're not feeling like you're being heard and you're not finding some relief, like moments of, well, you know, that would, if you're asking the question of how am I doing, that might be a good indicator that we might need to, and then you bring it up. I love clients giving me feedback. I want them to tell me. I check in. Did I, you know, was that okay? You know, could I do something differently? I think you want a therapist that's open to that. Mm-hmm. And if they're not, then that might be an indicator then to say, I'm going to go elsewhere.
Yeah.
Accountability and lack of ego are huge. And I can attest to that with you. And I kind of want to go back a little bit because we started talking about the polyvagal ladder.
Oh, yeah.
I want to hear Deborah's explanation of it, but I also want to explain that now that I know what I know about the polyvagal ladder, that is what I wish I would have used to seek out a therapist, because it will literally, and we'll post resources, mm-hmm. but it'll literally have, you know, across the ladder, it'll say, like, if you're having this experience, if you're feeling this, these will be your thoughts. These will be the feelings in your body. You're probably in this state. So I think if I could have had that as a guide, one, it would have helped me. I would have been relieved to know I was going to be okay. And there was a formula to getting okay. And two, I think it would have just, it would have just all around been validating and grounding to me. Because part of what kept me in that cycle of unlivable hypervigilance was not knowing if I was going to be okay.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So if you could just give us I know it's Stephen Porges.
Yes.
I know he was kind of the founding father. Mm-hmm. But if you could just take it away and explain what it is and how it works.
Absolutely. And so, and he actually worked with animals. Yeah. Anyways, he's back. Oh. So anyways, I love it because what he found was that the vagus nerve, which runs from the crown, the top of our head, all the way to the stomach. And that's why the gut health matters. All that matters. And so in this vagus nerve, when your needs are met and you're feeling safe and you're feeling loved, then we are able to be on the top of the ladder where we feel connected. We're social, we're engaging. Whereas once at that the amygdala, I use a dog in my book, once that dog is on 24/7 scanning your environment, and it just takes an eighth of a second for us to pick up a cue for a threat. So it can be a tone, a voice, like I said, it can be anything. And if you have, and so that means you activate your sympathetic state. which is the next. I also like to think about like an automatic manual in the car. You know how it's just
going a transmission.
You mean? Like the transmission. Yeah.
The automatic transmission. Okay.
So it's an autonomic nervous system, which is automatic.
Okay.
So you're not deciding this. This is just happening. So your nervous system picks up a threat. And if we have no memory of this going well, and if we have no calm, regulated person, they don't necessarily have to be calm, but they're with us. They get us. Then we can stay grounded and calm. However, most of the time we don't have that. So I'm going to go with, and so then we're mobilized, which means we're engaged, and that's fight, flight. We either want to fight. Mobilize means we need to fight or we need to get away from here. That's our sympathetic nervous system. So that's the next shift. That's the gear down.
Okay.
And then if that's not working, you're not getting any results. We tend to get so overwhelmed and flooded in those moments, then you automatically will go down to dorsal, which is shut down, collapse.
Got it. So when people, because I know for the longest time it was fight or flight, and then now I've heard fight, flight, or freeze. That freeze is like that next step down where you that just are like.
Right.
Okay.
And it can happen in many ways. And actually, to me, when I look at diagnosis of depression, that's actually been a person, that person's in dorsal. Because to get a diagnosis of depression, you have to be in that state for 6 weeks or more. That's dorsal. You are in collapse. You live there.
I was in collapse. I was in collapse so severely. Yeah. Looks like Teresa was too from all that.
Yes, me too.
Pointing.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why I'm here.
Yeah, you know, I've definitely taken a very long-term vacation to where? Satan's toilet.
Satan's toilet. That's right. That's exactly when we visit that space. I didn't add with the polyvagal theory that I always think it's really important for people to know that when you're in dorsal, you can't just jump up to ventral vagal, which is at the top of the ladder. You actually go through, you go from dorsal, like I said, it's like
dorsal
is the
bottom. Freeze, the
freeze,
like,
the shutdown, collapse. Shutdown. You feel hopeless, usually dark. And then that mobilized fight flight is sympathetic. And then you go to ventral vagal, which is when you feel connected. And the thing
ventral vagal, V-E-N-T-R-A-L, ventral vagal.
Correct. Okay. Vagal,
just for people who like to Google like I do.
Awesome. Uh-huh. And this is where a lot of people get stuck, especially with trauma histories, is that when you're in dorsal vagal, you will go to fight flight again, because you actually have to go through that state of the nervous system to get to ventral vagal. So then a lot of people will be like, oh my gosh, I got all this stuff to do. Oh my goodness. And then they fall right back to collapse.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people cycle.
Yeah. You explaining that to me and mixed states.
Yes.
And
I remember
you explaining that to me, and I was so relieved because I was like, oh my God, it's not working. My brain is broken. It's going to work on everyone but me.
Right. Oh my gosh.
It's uniqueness. Just like, terminal uniqueness. I suffered from that for a long time. It's literally like climbing a ladder. You can't go from the bottom to the top. You have to climb it. You might be able to skip a couple of rungs, but you know, you're going to have to climb it and you're going to have to go through. And it is still going to be a little uncomfortable, but if you know what's coming, that's really helpful.
Wow.
So that was the key point I want to make. Cause then that's where, and again, oftentimes what you need at dorsal to get out of, they're different. They're still good things. They're still very wonderful things that help you.
Got it.
So it gives you more energy to keep climbing when you're in fight or flight. That's for sure.
What gives you more energy? Sorry, I'm a little bit lost.
When you're in fight or flight. So when you're in the
collapse
state.
Oh, when you're in it,
state,
it can,
And then you get up into the fight or flight state. You're not to ventral vagal yet, but that energy you get from being in fight or flight can help you keep climbing.
Go up again,
Got it.
But a lot of, if you feel like, oh my gosh, here I am again, no progress has been made. Oh my gosh. Then you just fall right back to dorsal.
Yes. And that's what kept happening to me for a long time.
I feel attacked and seen.
It's both. She feels both. Pick a lane, Teresa. Which one is it?
Yes. And
that makes sense.
Amy. Yes. And
it's both.
And there's this ladder activity, which is the work of Deb Dana. She's actually a therapist who got a hold of Borges's work and then made it more adaptable to therapy. And so what you do is you say, you answer like some certain questions, and that's why you can identify I am, people are, the world is, and your answers mm-hmm. to that will indicate how that what state you're in.
And then that's right. I also you did that sensations. With me.
Yes.
When we did the Safe Sound Protocol, which yes. Teresa has also participated in.
Oh, I love Lovely. It. I absolutely Lovely. Love Safe Sound Protocol. And, you know, I joked earlier about the whole rebel, you know, Gretchen, I can't think of her name, but there's the different styles and one of them is rebel. Mm-hmm. It absolutely baffles me that some of the best things for me, like almost every morning, starting my day with a coloring book and mm-hmm. SSP. Once I get to a certain spot, I rebel. I'm like, I just push it all away. I don't need it. And then I'm super dysregulated, but I don't want to go back to the thing that I know works. It's the weirdest, you know, but yeah.
It's so common. It's yeah. so common.
Yeah.
Is that again, an IFS because, thing, Deborah?
Well, I would go deep now. If we were in a session, I would want to go deeper and to be curious about that. But I do also relate it to the nervous system as well, because although you know it's good, you also have to remember how many decades, I'm just going to guess decades, I don't know, Teresa, that you've been in dorsal or you had to have all these parts that protected you. Mm-hmm. So yes, the IFS is parts. And so you have these managers and firefighters who have been there. They have been holding the fort for you, keeping you safe. And what you needed to keep safe is not what keeps you to thrive in your adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
Yet those parts are still stuck and they still think they need to be on. And so they're like, no, don't you dare go do those other things because they're being perceived as a threat.
Isn't that their so role, interesting?
They will lose their job.
Yeah, well, so it's funny that you mentioned that when you were talking about the eighth of a second and the like mm-hmm. the moment. You,
yeah.
So for a long part of my professional career, I was in sales and I was an incredible salesperson. I won awards. I was the first woman to win a particular award at one of the companies I worked for, a sales award. Mm-hmm. You know, give me any account and I could grow it, no problem. And when I started really getting into some deep work and therapy work, I really started fighting that because I realized that part of my trauma, I transformed into a skill. And so mm-hmm. I could be in conversation with a client and I was reading them on a level that other people just did not notice. And I could, you know, walk into the lobby of a customer building and I could assess how people's days were going, which competitors who mm-hmm. were also in the lobby were a potential threat by who they were meeting with. I mean, it was just constant. And I was so afraid. I'll never forget that. I was so afraid that if I did the work to try to lose that hypervigilance, that somehow mm-hmm. I would be less successful. So it really resonates mm-hmm. with me when you say mm-hmm. that work is a perceived threat.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. To those parts. Right.
To those parts. Yeah. Wow.
And then of course, your nervous system. Exactly. So that's why we resent. So it makes, it really does.
That's wild. Yeah.
And this is where, again, where I love, we have to meet those parts with reverence and compassion and say, hey, wow, tell me about, we need to give them a voice now. Why? Because mm-hmm. you had to be hypervigilant to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So yeah. Serving as a great skill and helping you.
Yeah. Yeah. I associated it with like financial stability and, you know, professional acceptance, right? I mean, my goodness, I was winning awards, right?
But which is your livelihood, right?
It was my livelihood, but then I was making terrible personal decisions, you know? And
so interesting. And I want to go back to Deborah, how you're saying you have to approach these parts with curiosity and like, what is that about? Let's talk about just mm-hmm. getting to that point, I had such a manager, firefighter. I don't know. Those aren't necessarily the same thing, but
Protectors, though. They just come protectors. At different times. It's the timing.
Yeah. Such a burly protector, really like my inner critic, which is the work of Pete. Who is that guy who did the CPTSD surviving to thriving? Pete Walker.
Yes,
right?
There we go.
Is that his name? So I remember hearing about the inner critic, reading his book. And my inner critic is such a dick. It's such an asshole that it was really giving me a hard time about doing that work of becoming curious, because curiosity was so freaking vulnerable to me. And I wasn't allowed to do it as a child. My childhood was such that if I was just invisible and I laid on the couch watching TV and I stayed quiet and I wasn't noticed, I was okay. I was left alone for the most part. But if I got up and played, or I was really interested in music, if I played my mom's guitar, if I started to dance, if I started to express myself in a way that seemed joyful, my mom, I don't know why, she would like come and hunt me down and put me to work and scream at me and belittle me. And it was like she noticed I was existing and had to make me miserable in some way. So I still struggle, as you know, Deborah, I struggle to play with my child. It's really been an issue for me. And then there's guilt on top of that. I mean, the layers of stuff that there is to work through is mind-boggling. But yeah, that inner critic was just like, what an idiot. Right. Like, you don't get curious. And it really now I see was there to protect me mm-hmm. from going into a state that was too vulnerable for me as a kid. But I lived for years, and it'll still come up with this part that is just so belittling, and really kind of took on the voice of my mother, which is heinous. Yeah. That made it a little easier for me to detach from it and undo it when I thought of it as her voice. But man, that thing's a fucker. It's hard to.
They are ruthless. Ruthless, these parts. And I do want to acknowledge, like, yes, we want to get to curiosity and compassion is the hope. However, sometimes that you can't go, like, you can't even touch that. Like, you can't mm-hmm. even get to that. And so at bare minimum, I just say at least witness without judgment. Like that makes sense. I feel, or mm-hmm. even if you can say, I feel the same way to that part. I get why you're mad. Yeah, I'm mad too. Like joining empathy like that is like, can help mm-hmm. lead to curiosity wow. and compassion.
Yeah. Wow. I wanted to meet the inner critic with its own medicine. So there was a wrestling match in a sense for a while, because I would just be like, shut the fuck up.
Right.
Leave me alone. So it really did. It really was you training me, like, just try to, and it wouldn't let me do that. So at first I was just like, okay, it was really more me just witnessing. Okay. I hear that. I hear you. And then little by little, I was able to, like, that part didn't even want me to validate it, let alone the little vulnerable parts. And now I see why, because it's really painful. It's painful work. It's gnarly work. But I didn't have a choice. My stuff was just erupting.
Yeah.
It was coming out. So,
go ahead. No, please go for it.
That is like the one of the main definitions of trauma. It's not the event. It's what happened without an empathetic witness. Mm. And that's why us going back and providing that empathetic witness at each of those ages and stages is just essential.
Oh, yeah, look, we both are like blown away. Teresa's holding her heart. Right. I put my hand over my mouth. That is so incredibly.
Yeah. Without true. It's that mm-hmm. without an empathetic witness. And that's where, when you were saying these events, like you started, Teresa, at the beginning, there's that trauma of neglect. It's what you didn't get mm-hmm. when you needed it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, to the people listening, like, trauma isn't just one thing. Right. And PTSD doesn't come from just one type of event or absence of something. You know, it can be so many different things. So we talked around it a little bit, but would you mind going into IFS? It's kind of funny. There's a enterprise resource planning system called IFS. And so when you talk about it, that's all I can think of. I think their headquarters are down the highway from where I live.
Oh, funny.
So you're saying internal family
systems. That's what it stands for.
Yeah. So can you kind of describe, is that playing with your inner child, or is there something more to it?
There's a lot more to it. Absolutely. Okay. So it really was developed about 40 years from Dr. Richard Schwartz. And it's funny, I actually have a joke about this too, because in grad school, 20 years ago, one of my professors would bring it up, but they never really taught it. I was like, come on. But it like never really made sense until about 6 years ago. I finally got it. Like, kept coming up. I'm like, I know it's important. I know it matters. And then I think, you know what? Oh, my parts didn't want me to get it because they knew my whole life would fall apart. Because they've been holding it together. But I love it because it actually, I'm trained in systems because I'm a family therapist. So this model was originally developed from actually working with a lot of young people with eating disorders. And then we use the language of parts. And then he had noticed like the same principles that you're doing in family therapy is actually what's going on in your head, because your mind is not just your mind. It is a collective of everybody and everything in your life. And so all those people in your life become in your mind. There's parts.
Interesting.
So we have parts of us. That's why we feel part of you wants to do this. Part of you wants to do that. And he found that there's three main parts where the exiles are the wounded inner children. Those usually come out in feeling shame, and worthlessness and all these negative feelings and vulnerable. Whereas we have manager parts and then protector parts. We have managers that are on 24/7 that don't want you to get vulnerable. They don't want you to feel shame. And so they're controlling, they're perfectionistic, they're on all the time. And then we have firefighters that come out once you've felt vulnerable or a wound has come up, or an exile has popped up, then a firefighter comes out to save the day. Which are more ragey, fiery, hot addictions can fall in this category.
Interesting.
And a lot of time, all these parts are blended in your psyche,
right?
Trying to keep you alive, to keep you whole. Yet at the essence, we are all whole. There's an essence in us, a self. That when we are in self, we feel 8 C's. He has compassion, curious, creative. I always, whenever I have a list, I forget the whole list. 8 C's, clarity. That's some of them. There's 8 C's.
there's eight of them.
Yes. 8 C's.
Got it. Okay.
And that's when you know you're leading from self. And the work of IFS is to be curious and to identify these parts.
And for me, it really was that curiosity piece. Once the firefighter that inner critic, like that loudest one, once that kind of relinquished control just a little bit and started to trust self just a little bit, I could operate from self a little bit more. I did start to delve into my creativity a little bit more, but I was able to get curious then. And after the curiosity, there then came some of the creativity. So it really resonates. And I think Lisa, I almost called you Lisa. Like, that's your new name, co-host.
Teresa. No, just for the record, no.
Sometimes right before I get a migraine, I say the wrong words. So I better take a Ubrelvy.
You better take a Ubrelvy because you're cutting my hair tomorrow.
That's correct. I will take one tonight.
So I found that
I think you were looking up the 8 C's. Coconut?
No. No.
Just kidding.
And Chubby Checker is not in there either.
No. How about cocaine? One of them must be cocaine, right?
Very much not. It is.
Whoops.
Whoops. Yeah.
I did it wrong.
Yet again. That was a different episode, the one where we show up and suck and fuck it all up.
But, well, we're doing that all the time.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I have a feeling that that is going to be a running theme. And dear listener, please hang with it because, So it's curiosity, compassion, clarity, connectedness, creativity, courage, confidence, and calm.
Amazing.
Yes.
And I can honestly say I experience most of those most days now. And to go from hardly being able to stand up, like I remember flying to the inpatient program, which was in Pennsylvania. I remember flying and having a hard time standing at my gate to get on the plane. And to go from that to what I just said, that I'm experiencing most of those 8 C's and sometimes coconut, but never cocaine. I've actually never tried it. To experiencing those most of the days, that is nothing short of a miracle. I mean, our brains and bodies, it was taking this approach that I need to heal my brain and my body.
Yeah.
That changed everything. I wanted to ask Deborah to speak to how that correlates to, what do we call, it used to be called multiple personality disorder. Mm-hmm. How does that relate? Is it somehow,
I think,
correlated?
It is still the same thing, to be honest. I mean, I think obviously multiple, I mean, a lot of people actually will still not want to do, when I bring up IFS, actually a lot of people will be like, oh, that feels like I'm crazy. I don't want to go there. So I can't use it with some people because they're like, oh no. But I think all diagnosis, and then because multiple personality is a personality disorder. And so then you have mood disorders. And so to me, the personality disorders are more of those ones that are more that trauma occurred, or that the whatever they did, those coping skills, which are likely those parts, are more fixed. You know, they needed them for so long, and there's more too. Like, actually, I didn't even bring up Dr. Dan Siegel, who talks about, we know that a nervous system is flexible, is in a is well integrated. I haven't used that word often, but integrated is the goal of all this work we're doing, is how do we bring up all this that happened and integrate it, so that it, and that's how we get to that calm. And I think for people with multiple personality disorder, it is those parts that, but that they are also so rigid, they have they, and because we can't handle, like, you know, we say yes and in an unintegrated brain, if the whole thing is unintegrated, you can't even conceive and.
Mm-mm.
Right?
Oh, like, interesting.
No. You can't.
Okay.
That
it's
makes
so
sense.
So rigid. And so you actually go through with Dan Siegel's work is like, you're in flow. Our goal is to be regulate. It's FACES is his acronym. FACES, it's flexible, adaptive, coherent narratives. You're coherent, energized, and stable flow. And that's where we know our nervous system is getting its needs met and getting the right amount of stimulation. Whereas when we're overstimulated, we'll bank on rigidness and chaotic. And you're, and some people are more rigid, you know, and so, and some are more chaotic. So it's like, those are more fixed traits now. They've become more fixed, those parts. And so they're a lot more solid and taking over. Yet I do believe that IFS could work in those situations. Because again, those are, people are being stigmatized. They're not crazy. Those parts came on to save them, to take on a persona, to get their needs met, so that they felt safe, seen, soothed, and secure in those moments. So
safe,
seen, soothed,
and secure.
Safe, seen, soothed.
That's also from the work of Dan Siegel, because really that's what we're doing through parenting, is that's what we want to do. You need to feel safe, seen, soothed. And then that security comes by that consistency. And that's why self-care routines. Security comes as a result of those being met consistently.
It helps me so much every time you remind me of that, because my fear is always that I'm traumatizing my child, and that they are traumatized watching me go through this process. And they have been. There's no denying that. And we're trying to work through some of that now. But hearing this reminds me that even in my worst state, I was still able to soothe. I was still able to see. And Deborah shared with me, it's something like doing it right, like 30% at a time, that's really good and enough kind of create those three pieces.
Yes, that safe, seen, soothe. So if you hit that mark, the technical research was 33.333% of the time for most children. If you are helping them feel safe, seen, soothe, at least 33.3% of the time.
Yeah.
I'm holding up my knuckle tattoos for everyone to see. It's 333. No, right. It's an angel number.
Angel number, yeah.
And that's okay. The work of Doreen Virtue. And I looked it up. 333 was my favorite number as a little kid. And I never knew why. And I looked it up when I heard about angel numbers, and it was something to the effect of, I think Teresa is going to look it up for me now. Something to the effect of being surrounded by benevolent, protective beings. And that really touched me.
Yeah.
Because it has to be true. There is no reason other than this work really does heal. There's no reason I should be normal. After what I've seen and gone through and experienced. So yeah, that's where the 333 came from.
But let's be honest.
It happens to also apply to 33.3% of the time. I'm a decent mom.
Yes. Good enough parenting. I promote that.
Good enough. Well, God, and isn't that what Bethany Hall said too?
Yes,
right?
We were talking about that with Bethany.
Yeah,
it just needs good to be good and enough.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing.
It's not us waving a flag. And,
right. Because we need ruptures. Defeat. The ruptures are going to happen. It's the repair that matters most. There are, for children who are more sensitive, that it does go up to 50%. But still, that's still an F, I tell everybody. That's still an F. So look at that.
Yeah. You can still fail and be okay.
Totally.
Now, at the top of the show, did I hear this right? Deborah, do you live in New Zealand?
Well, yes, I have most of the last 15 years, but currently I'm caregiving my mother. So
okay.
I'm in Illinois.
Oh, got it. Okay. All right. Wow. Wow. Well, we're lucky we're very, very lucky to have you here.
Yeah.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I wanted to ask Deborah about her book before we close.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yes, which actually I did develop with my work in Lake Villa, Illinois, about 8 years ago. I used to work at a wellness center. So I've been back and forth. I've grown in Chicagoland area, been raised here. Because I wanted to help the kids that I was working with understand how they bring, because again, agency is so important. You being able to feel in control to anything you can. So I love teaching about the brain. And also when I'm working with parents, I want them to know that kids are not acting up because they want to be mean and make your life difficult. They literally, their nervous system is overwhelmed and stressed and they need support. They need connectedness to help them through. So I developed this book called How to Train My Brain. And it's a personal guidebook. And I have it originally to be downloaded. I'm going to be publishing it soon to make it available for people to download and print it out initially. I'm working so that they can put it in their own binders, because it's really important that each child, they get to color all over it. And it's teaching about...
Oh, wow. It's like a coloring.
Yeah, coloring book. It's a coloring book. It's interactive.
It's your jam, Teresa.
It is totally my jam. I mean, the kid in me really would love that, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. And I could have my SSP going and just color away.
Yes, I am a certified SSP provider too, so I welcome that as well. I have so many services that I offer. You can check out my website, Deborah Wallace. Oh, yeah. Therapy.com.
Deborah Wallace Therapy.com. So DeborahWallace Therapy, therapy.com.
Yes.
Got it. We'll put it
also on.
Yeah.
Awesome. And then I also obviously have one-on-one sessions that I provide. And I'm also looking, I used to do workshops and I want to bring in more workshops and for parents. I love working with parents because to me, getting the first 3 years of life creates the blueprint for all future relationships. And that relationship is creating the nervous system. Like think about that 0 to 7. You are building that nervous system for how that individual will process life forever. Mm-hmm.
That explains so much.
Yes. This is something Deborah has also worked with me and the kiddo and my ex-husband. I mean, she's done sessions with my ex-husband and I who, you know, we've had difficulty relating and has brought us to these places where we've had these amazing breakthroughs as a divorced couple. So, and that way we can better parent our child together. And I can't even begin to tell you how helpful that's been because, you know, being raised by a traumatized mother had an impact on my kid. So some of it is going back and, trying to heal some of that together and learning as I go. I'm learning on the job. And
yeah,
I kind of just had to jump and build my wings on the way down. And you've helped us with that so much. And some of it was stuff from the book. It's been amazing.
I don't know about that, Amy. I mean, I was raised by a traumatized mother. Look at me.
You're doing great. I don't know if you're trying to belittle yourself or build yourself up. Either way, I'm baffled because you're one of my favorite humans, and I'm so in awe of all this stuff that you are able to not just try but be good at and master. It's mind blowing. It's a really rare combination.
I just fake it well. I just fake it well.
Bull crap.
Right. Deborah, yourself is leading.
I'm going to send you some of her quilting stuff. It's art. It's incredible. You'll see.
Thank you. Well, Deborah, it has been amazing to have you on our podcast. You are a gift. Thank you as Amy's friend for bringing her back to my partner and me. I hadn't known you, Amy, a very long time when you got to that place. And it has been a true gift to see you come back from it. And I'm so grateful for the friendship that we've created on the other side of all of that trauma. And Deborah, it sounds like you are part of the reason why we are able to be, you know, and have this close friendship and start this podcast and do all of these things. And so thank you for that.
Thank you. And thank you, Teresa, for being an empathetic witness. I'm trying not to.
Okay.
It's really emotional. It was really, your love, your and Joel's love and acceptance. And they literally, Deborah, at one point, and I believe I mentioned this to you, said, if you ever need a place to live, if you, because that started to scare me too. So I'm detached from my family. I'm divorced. When you're in that state, it's hard to relate to. It's hard for people to understand what's going on. There's a lot of judgment. And one of my fears was, where am I going to go? What's going to happen to me? And they literally were like, come and live with us if you need a place to live. And that was so incredibly healing. Mm-hmm. So you're very much a part of the process too.
Yes.
I love you so much. I'm so grateful for both of you. Thank you.
You're so welcome. It's often a lot of little things, and healing is always possible. The nervous system is so resilient. It's a phenomenal, and we're all born whole.
Yeah.
Like it never really went away. It's just that all those stuff locked us, yet it's always there. And that's why I love teaching people how to tap into it.
Wow.
It was really, healing is possible. Just hang on. Please don't give up before the miracle happens.
Yeah.
And as we get into more episodes, I would like to share more of my story. It's pretty freaking gnarly. It's Deborah can attest to this. There are still times that I'm sharing things that I'm like, was that real?
Mm-hmm.
Was that real? But it's come up enough times and there are enough details that as it comes into view, I'm able to digest and do the very foundation of this podcast, which is the golden rule of improv. Yes. And yes, that happened to me and I can level this up.
Yeah.
Thanks to this kind of work. And it really is, Deborah, that you do such an amalgam of things. There isn't any one thing. Like when I was going to EMDR, and please don't let, I don't want people to shy away from EMDR. It has to be done with a certain protocol.
Right. Yeah.
So we can also put some of that in our show notes, mm-hmm. what the protocol mm-hmm. is that you want to look for so that you don't end up in a situation like I did. But that was like all that person offered. And the fact that you do some EMDR, you do the container work, you do the somatic experiencing and the polyvagal, and you did so many different things, and that was perfect. It was exactly what I needed. And I'm so grateful. So look for someone that offers a lot of stuff. If you can't get in and see Deborah, who will do Zoom, then find somebody who does a lot of these things, because chances are you're going to need kind of a handful. Mm-hmm. It takes a village and it takes a whole bunch of healing modalities too.
When you were talking, Amy, I thought of, Deborah, you're like a psychological quilter. You just take a little bit of this and a little bit of this mm-hmm. and, you know, stitch it all together in a way to help people comfort themselves.
Yes. Oh, so I love that. Aww. Oh, that's beautiful.
That's beautiful.
And each quilt is unique because I meet them where they're at.
Exactly.
I have to meet them.
You got to deal with the scraps you're given.
That's right.
And stitch it back together using various tools, right?
That's beautiful. And I look forward to seeing one of your quilts.
Yeah.
It is beautiful.
Our podcast is not a substitute for professional mental health services. If you're finding joy and connection in our episodes, consider supporting us by subscribing, rating, and reviewing on your favorite podcast platform. Follow us on Instagram at HilariousPod for more behind-the-scenes fun. Thank you for being an essential part of our journey. Until next time, remember, healing is not just about the pain. It's also about the laughter that comes after.